So what's your impression of the Iraqi election? Great triumph of democracy, imperial ruse, or what?
Well, I think it is largely a ruse. I think the United States agreed to the elections for the following reasons. I mean, some of the journalists like Tommy Friedman and the fellow who writes in the Washington Post, whose name escapes me, were arguing that the main reason for the election was that it would create a sort of semi-legitimate government which could then have a real civil war and wipe out the resistance. I think these people are going to be disappointed. I think the new government, if it is incapable of getting rid of the occupying armies and creating a law and order situation in Iraq, will tumble. It won't last too long, because the only forces it could use to crush the armed resistance is the occupying army, which would be like committing suicide. So I don't think that is going to happen too easily. Secondly, the Shiites themselves are split. Muqtada al-Sadr did not take part in the elections. He is publicly now called for talks between him and many Sunni groups, both religious and secular, saying we have to keep Iraq united. What the elections have done is basically united the West. The French and Germans are now back on board, agreeing to train puppet troops in Iraq, help with security operations, but have not promised to send their own troops there, which in itself is indicative. So it's a mixed bag, the results of the election, and I think what is really happening is that there's a new phase now we're entering into in the struggle for Iraq. I mean, if you read some of the stuff which Kenan Makiya is publishing, basically they're saying Iraq should neither be Arab nor Shia, but pro-American. But, you know, this is something which is foolish, because it's not going to happen easily. The Kurds are pressing for Kurdish independence, and they don't even mind if essentially all that it is an Israeli-American protectorate. Now, nothing is solved by this election, and accept it with public opinion in the West, which, after all, is not the determining factor in what happens in Iraq. So I think the next 6 months are going to be crucial.
What kind of government do you suppose is likely to emerge from this? Are the divisions in Iraqi society so deep that a credible and legitimate government would be very difficult to cobble together? Are they going to...
I think it's going to be very difficult. The British, you know, stayed in Iraq from 1920 to 1956, and they could never really cobble together a government which had any genuine legitimacy. And I think the United States are going to find it even more difficult. I mean, any government, I mean, leaving aside the actual nature of the elections, you know, there's no real register, no actual record of how many people voted, how they voted, who voted. It's just chaos from that point of view. But let's leave all that aside for the moment and just concentrate on your question. I do not think that a government which is dependent on foreign occupying armies will be seen by the Iraqis as a legitimate government. It just doesn't happen like that. So they're not going to be able to crush the armed resistance.
And the U.S. didn't really want elections in the first place, so how tolerant do you suppose Washington would be of an actual government that emerged?
I'm not so sure about that. I think they wanted an election which they could totally control, like the one in Afghanistan. They wanted a similar election in Iraq so that their boy Alawi could be re-elected, but that was never on in Iraq, precisely because the Shia groups threatened that if they tried to impose Alawi in power through a fake election, they would join the resistance. So from that point of view, there was some pressure. They've now got probably a Hakim Chalabi government. Don't forget that Ahmad Chalabi is an old intelligence hand as far as the United States is concerned. So they've lost. Alawi doesn't have any standing at all. So the figures coming out that he may have 11 or 28% just shows the elections were totally fraudulent, because the guy is without a base. His base is in the United States. Chalabi has linked up with the gang of Hakim Shiite group which was very close to Tehran and still is. So the United States may well have to deal with Chalabi, who will undoubtedly be their man in the new regime. But the new regime will be a Shiite government, and I think there will be a big debate within it as to the sort of constitution they want. It is not at all impossible that they might insist on a theocratic constitution, which will be a supreme irony, Doug, if that happens, that this is what it's all come down to.
And what about the possibilities for a Shia alliance with Iran? That certainly would be Washington's nightmare. How likely is that to happen?
It could happen if the United States carries on behaving stupidly towards the Iranians. Condi Rice in Europe this week has been really talking up U.S. pressure on Iran. My own feeling is that it's bluff, that they're not going to do anything, because from their own point of view, if they decided to the Iranian mullahs at this precise point in time, could destabilize southern Iraq and Afghanistan. In both cases, the Iranian mullahs have helped them and have been their allies. So the notion they can take Iran on at the moment is just a joke, Doug. Quite honestly, that would fit them off, and the Pentagon must know it. I mean, even if they carry out surgical strikes against the Iranians, it's not going to work.
You mentioned Condoleezza Rice and her debut trip as Secretary of State. What kind of impression did she make in Europe?
She's made an awful impression, you know, even on people who are now sort of desperate to be very pro the United States. In France, she met a group of tame intellectuals who were pretty shocked, you know, and she's been referred to in the French press as the warrior princess and stuff like this, precisely because she's been talking up the sort of neocon dream of invading Iran. But I really fail to understand what purpose is served, even looking at it from the point of view of the United States at the moment, to attack the Iranians. They don't have the military strength to do it. The Iranian army is very strong compared to Saddam's army. They will fight. They have an air force. And they will then say it right. If you want to play it like that, we will unleash our forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, which are not inconsiderable.
Now, there's been, of course, a lot of talk of repairing the transatlantic alliance. What kind of shape is that in?
I think they are repairing it. And here the Iraqi elections have been used by the German and French elites to clamber back onto the bandwagon. Basically, since Bush's re-election, the French and Germans have been looking for a way back, and now they've used the Iraqi election to do it. And I think that they will now mend the barriers. However, if the United States does, which I can't believe, but if they do go for Iran, that'll mark a big break between Europe and America for another few years. Because even the British, who are otherwise totally servile, are completely opposed to invading Iran. And the British Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, actually went out of his way and said that Britain could not and would not support any attack on Iran.
Noam Chomsky, whom we'll hear from later in the program, argues that the saber rattling against Iran is just for show to shake up the leadership there and to scare people around the world, but he doesn't believe that an invasion is really likely. What do you think?
I agree with Noam on this. I think it's a bluff, hoping that by constantly saying this, they will either compel the regime to surrender and stop its nuclear program, or trigger off an insurrection. None of this is likely to happen. In fact, this saber rattling has exactly the opposite impact. It strengthens the most hardline elements within the clerical regime and weakens the reformers. So the United States has done this many a time before, and it's foolish, actually.
Turning to a different part of the world, the Bush administration is turning up the heat a bit on Venezuela. You've been visiting there and talking to Chavez and the people around him. What do you think?
I think that they're not going to be able to get away with anything there. Even if they use the Colombians to unleash a war, it'll be very unpleasant. But I think the overwhelming majority of Venezuelans would resist. And Chavez recently in Porto Alegre made it very clear. He said, Condoleezza Rice talks about me as if I was an irritation, like, he said, wearing a prickly shirt on your body. but he said, we're an independent sovereign state. And learn something, he said to her in public, this was, from what you're encountering in Iraq, in Venezuela. He said the resistance would be stronger and much tougher.
The northern or western left has not been paying all that much attention to Venezuela. What's your evaluation of what's going on there?
Well, I think the western left has been caught sleeping, largely because Chavez comes from a military background. And so there's a gut reaction, oh, he's a military man. Well, he is a military man. But, you know, you've had military men in different parts of the West before, not least in the United States. The thing is, the guy is very radical. He's basically the only leader in the world now. And Venezuela is the only country where you have a government which is a coalition of small political parties and big social movements. All the social movements are represented in the Venezuelan government. That's what the Bolivarian movement is. It's a combination of political parties and social movements. And this is why Chavez has won electorally five times, which is unheard of when the United States has been trying to get rid of him and has made three big attempts. What the Venezuelan experience is, and they themselves are very honest about it. They said, you know, we haven't yet done anything very radical. All we have pushed through is reforms in health, education, public housing, and now agrarian reforms. The latest agrarian reform they are pushing through will affect some of the corporations, U.S. corporations, who had bought up land there for producing genetically modified crops, which the Venezuelan government is opposed to. So I think they're going to take that land back. Whether they will pay compensation or confiscate it is the only question. I think they will probably pay some token compensation to avoid any hassle, but they are going to take it back. So it's, how would one describe it? One would call it a left social democratic reforming government, which 25 years ago wouldn't have excited anyone, but today in a sort of epoch of total neoliberal capitalism is very exciting, and it shows that if there is a government, it can resist.
My impression is that Chavez and his people are very aware of the constraints they're operating under and would like to be more than a left social democratic government, but to understand that they really couldn't at this moment. Is that correct?
This is absolutely accurate, Doug, what you've just said. And that is my impression as well. And I think they're handling it very well and not moving too far ahead of their own people and popular support for them and their project. And I think they will deepen the process as we move along. But already, in many ways, Chavez is, in terms of mass mobilizations, gone way beyond Allende. That was the last attempt. And certainly, the Cubans feel that their isolation has, for the first time, been really broken in Latin America. The big tragedy is that Lula in Brazil has gone down exactly the opposite road. If he had learned even a few of the lessons of Venezuela, then Latin America today would have been offering the whole world an example.
Well, why did Lula not take a bolder
route? It's a very interesting question, this, and I've been trying, you know, I was in Brazil lately, just a few weeks ago, and I think it's a strange thing, this, that the PT, which is an old workers' party, has been affected by the same disease which has gripped former communist parties, social democratic parties. Curiously enough, the more organized they are, the more they've gone for this line of we can't buck the system. And the Venezuelans, not having a strong party structure but having strong social movements and feeling they could rely on them, have done it. But I think Lula is surrounded by people. He himself is a weak politician. I mean, I was thinking about who he reminds me of, and he's a sort of strange mixture of Lech Walesa, the Polish workers' leader, and Tony Blair. If they could have a baby, it would be Lula. And I think he just hasn't got the guts to do anything. He's so happy being in power that that's all that matters. And the people around him are a group of hard-nosed politicians, including, incidentally, ex-Trotskyists, ex-Marxists, who defend the neoliberal global system with the same dogma as they used to defend their own sectarian policies 15 to 20 years ago. It's quite a strange phenomenon, this. And so they are basically not doing anything that would upset the international economic system, including letting repression be carried out against landless peasants. João Pedro Stedile told me, the leader of the landless peasants movement, said that under Lula, in the first few years, there had been more repression than under the previous regime. He pointed out this is not repression carried out by the state, but by private hoodlums in the pay of landlords, but the state does nothing to stop it.
Is there some difference in between Venezuela and Brazil because of Venezuela's oil money? They're counting what, $50 billion a year in oil income. Certainly, it does increase your freedom of maneuver, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And there's no doubt that that is an important important difference. On the other hand, the Brazilians had wealth. They got rid of most of it by selling it all to and allowing it to be privatized. And Lula is now busy privatizing pensions on the Pinochet model, whereas the pension schemes in Chile is in very serious trouble. So it's partially, I mean, the oil is an important factor, Doug, but it's also a lack of will and determination, because things can be done. You know, even things we don't cost that much money if you're in an oppositional mood. And I have no doubt that what Chavez is now calling for, a Bolivarian Federation of Latin American Republics, they would sell oil at very low prices in order to help other countries. I mean, they're doing that with the Cubans, for instance.
Still, looking at Argentina, Ecuador, Peru, it does seem that the neoliberal project is in a bit of trouble in Latin America, doesn't it?
No doubt about it. I've always said that this was the first laboratory of neoliberal experimentation, and it's the first wave of rebellions all over Latin America. Argentina was the most dramatic example, but elsewhere is exactly the same. The big problem, there's no doubt the project is in trouble, but where there are problems is that there is no real alternative project, which is why Porto Alegre was very interesting this year, in the sense that the two alternatives offered, on offer, leaving aside the, you know, social movements and the groups who meet and talk each year, which is sort of interesting. But the big interventions, one was Lula and the other was Chavez. And that is the alternative on offer now in Latin America. I mean, Chavez has suddenly become a big Latin American figure.
Now, there was a bit of controversy at the Porto Alegre over, I believe you're one of the signatories of a letter or a declaration that the movement should start actually taking positions and develop something like a political agenda. Well,
yeah.
Tell us the story behind that.
Well, look, what basically happened is that there were lots of people there who were very angry that there was no, that the war in Iraq, which is the big event globally, was not the center of attention. You know, people were going on as if nothing was going on elsewhere in the world. I mean, there are a few discussions on the war. And there is a group of NGOs and some of its sort of Brazilian patrons who were quite happy to keep Porto Alegre as a talk shop, but which doesn't do anything in a combined way. It doesn't have any centralized campaigns. So basically, the two key figures of Le Monde Diplomatique, Ignacio Ramone and Bernard Cassin, drafted this two-page statement and asked me to sign it and others, and we did. I mean, to be honest, it's a very weak statement from my point of view, but I signed it just so that there was at least something coming out of Porto Alegre. And I think many people feel that there is a lack of this. The NGOs don't, because they live in their own bubbles. But many ordinary people who come, who are not part of the NGOs, want something more. They don't want a political party, but they want to be part of a movement which does something. And from that point of view, the statement wasn't too bad. And I think the fact that the next big Latin American forum, which is what Porto Alegre by and large is, because the attendance from the rest of the world is minimal, but the next, what they're calling the big forum of the Americas, North and South America, will be in Caracas next year. And Asia and Africa will have their own, and then we'll meet together once every 2 years. I think it could even be longer than that, because if they are regionalized, they could actually become more concrete.
The statement was quickly denounced as, first of all, I think it had 19 all-male signers, but also it was denounced as a project of authoritarians and celebrity hounds. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, you know, what can we say? There are some people who are just so hostile to any form of organized politics that it's embarrassing. And without doubt, the organizers of it should have got more names and probably would have. It was done very rapidly and hurriedly, but I think they could have got thousands of signatures if they'd gone out to do it, and that should have been done, but it wasn't done. So, I mean, it's not that I'm not critical of it myself, despite signing it, but I think to attack it as a project is foolish, actually. I mean, what if half of them had been women? Would that have made some of these people any happier? I doubt it.
This movement, the social forums, the broad anti-war movement that has sprung up in the last 5 or 10 years does seem to have reached some kind of organizational and ideological impasse. It's just serial protest and conventioneering. But is there any chance it's going to become a more substantial organized political force?
Well, if you, they're two separate things, Doug. In my opinion, the anti-war movement virtually disappeared after the occupation of Iraq when it was needed most. Wherever you look, it disappeared. There's not been any single big demonstration against the occupation. There have been small ones, but, you know, you're back to what it was like before the big mobilizations. The social movements have remained intact, but outside Latin America, there are very few of them. Outside Latin America, it's mainly NGOs who, as I was debating Professor Neil Ferguson at Minneapolis, I think it was early this year, was it late last, no, last autumn, and he said something very interesting, and this is someone I disagreed with on every other statement he'd made, and he said the NGOs are very important for the empire, which he supports, by the way, and I looked up, and he said in the old days the British could just send missionaries, you know, religious missionaries, to convert people to Christianity. Well, that can't be done any longer, but the NGOs are the new missionaries of the empire. I did agree with that, and they certainly, many of them, even unknowingly operate like that. Probably they'd be very shocked to hear this, but that's how they do operate. And I think the time is coming to make the thing more concrete, which is why the regionalization, I think, is important, to discuss common problems, not to think that institutional atomization is of itself a good thing. It isn't. It's interesting, but on its own it does nothing. You have to get together on certain common aims, and continent by continent it probably will work more effectively. I mean, don't forget it was set up as a rival to Davos, which is a, you know, sort of talk shop of the rich, and this was meant to be something which was a talk shop of the others, but now it needs to be more than just a talk shop.
And finally, you thought it was important to defeat George Bush in November. That didn't happen. What do you think of the second Bush administration and the political prospects?
I pointed out to against all those who said that a victory for Bush would help the anti-war movement and people would concentrate their minds on building up movements, etc. And I pointed out that there would be demoralization in the ranks if Bush was reelected, because it would be a sign that the American public was going for him. And the fact that he had 2 million more votes than Kerry or something like that is an indication that the, you know, anti-Bush forces failed to win the masses, to use an old-fashioned phrase. I'm not that interested in the electoral vote. The popular vote is actually very interesting. So it was a big victory for Bush, and I think people should take stock of that, that it reflects something in American society which they were not thinking about, which is why people like me, I mean, I felt instinctively that a defeat for Bush would be seen globally and in the United States as a tiny step forward, regardless of Kerry's politics. The fact that the inauguration of Bush, I mean, the turnout of the opposition, dissenting voices, was just utterly pathetic, is an indication of how demoralized people are, which I must say, not that I particularly want to go on about it, vindicates the position some of us took at the time.
Well, it's kind of it's hard to imagine what message an anti-war or an anti-inauguration demonstration would have. The people have spoken and we disagree.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's all. I mean, no, basically, if there had been a massive upsurge of anti-war sentiment after Bush's election victory, it could have been reflected saying, bring the boys and girls back home, bring the troops back home now, end the occupation, etc. But that's not how things work, alas.